As Lakesh made for the operations center, the lights in the main corridor were dimmed, as they were for 8 out of every 24 hours, to simulate nightfall. He heard a clinking of metal from a side passageway and turned down that way. He stopped in front of an open door, bearing a keypad rather than a knob. He hesitated for just a second before entering, looking warily around the wide, low-ceilinged room. Most of the furnishings consisted of desks and computer terminals. A control console ran the length of the right-hand wall, glass-encased readouts and liquid crystal displays flickering and flashing. A complicated network of glass tubes, beakers, retorts, Bunsen burners, and microscopes covered 3 black-topped lab tables. Upright panes of glass formed the left wall. A deeply recessed room stretched on the other side of the glass. Although there was no longer a reason for it, the room was dully lit by an overhead neon strip, glowing a dull red. Despite the gleaming chromium, glass, and electronic consoles, the room exuded the atmosphere of a cobwebby attic in an old abandoned house, holding the accumulated bric-a-brac of lost dreams.
"Is anyone in here?"
"Just us salvagers."
He walked to the doorway and saw the woman kneeling in front of an open cabinet, apparently examining its contents. She greeted him with a broad, infectious smile that he couldn't help but return, and nodded to the assorted odds and ends in the cabinet. Dr. Mariah Falk wasn't beautiful or young, but she was attractive. Her short chestnut-brown hair was threaded with gray at the temples. Deep creases curved out from either side of her nose to the corners of her mouth. Dark-ringed brown eyes gazed up at him from beneath long brows that hadn't been plucked in years, if ever.
"What are you doing here, Mariah?"
"Just checking on the kinds of materials in storage. We could move them out to a regular supply room, right? There's no reason not to find a use for this facility, is there? I mean, your guest is gone for good, right?"
"Yes, I suppose he is."
It had never occurred to him during Balaam's 3.5 years of imprisonment in the glass-walled cell that he would miss him when he was gone. Of course, it had never occurred to him that Balaam would ever be gone. Lakesh hadn't thought that far ahead. After a couple of years, he had ceased to view the entity as a prisoner or as a source of information about the Archon Directorate. Instead, Balaam had become a trophy, a sentient conversation piece, like a one-item freak show. In hindsight, it was fairly apparent that Balaam had chosen to remain in the Cerberus Redoubt for reasons of his own. He had used his psionic abilities to manipulate Banks, his former warder, into initiating a dialogue when he probably could just as easily have manipulated the man into releasing him.
"Well, carry on."
"You don't mind me doing this, do you?"
"Not at all. This room should be converted into something useful, now that we actually need the space. For a long time it served as a prison for a sentient entity. There's no need to make it a shrine now that he's gone."
Lakesh briefly considered stopping by the cafeteria and brewing a cup of green Bengali tea, but decided to put that task low on the priority list. He walked to the central control complex, the nerve center of the redoubt. The long, high-ceilinged room was filled with comp terminals and stations. The central control complex had 5 dedicated and 8 shared subprocessors, all linked to the mainframe behind the far wall. 200 years ago, it had been an advanced model, carrying experimental, error-correcting microchips of such a tiny size that they even reacted to quantum fluctuations. Biochip technology had been employed when it was built, protein molecules sandwiched between microscopic glass and metal circuits. On the opposite side of the operations center, an anteroom held the 8-foot-tall mat-trans chamber, rising from an elevated platform. Upright slabs of translucent, brown-hued armaglass formed 6 walls around it. Bright flares showed like bursts of distant heat lightning on the other side of the walls of the jump chamber. Armaglass had been manufactured in the last decades of the 20th century from a special compound that plasticized and combined the properties of steel and glass. It was used as walls in the jump chambers to confine quantum energy overspills. The emitter array within the platform emitted a low, steady hum as the device cycled through the materialization process. Lakesh didn't even glance at the indicator lights of the huge Mercator relief map of the world that spanned one entire wall. Pinpoints of light shone steadily in almost every country, connected by a thin, glowing pattern of lines. They represented the Cerberus network, the locations of all functioning gateway units across the planet. The Mat-Trans unit on Luna wasn't represented on the map. 6 people were sitting in front of computer stations. Monitor screens flashed incomprehensible images and streams of data in machine talk. In the cool semi-darkness, the huge room hummed with the quietly efficient chatter of the system operators. The control center was surprisingly well-manned, particularly for the late hour, but inasmuch as the complex was the brain of the redoubt, it naturally attracted personnel from all quarters. Most of the people sitting at the various stations were émigrés from the Menetius moon base. Nora Pennick, Brewster Filboid, and two men he knew only as Marsh and Everson. The only long-term Cerberus staff members he saw were Farrell and Bry. Marsh, a wiry man of medium height with uncombed hair, manned the biolink transponder monitor. He greeted Lakesh with an embarrassing deference.
The transponder signal shows strong, sir.
Lakesh glanced at the monitor screen upon which three white icons throbbed and pulsed.
So I see. And please, don't call me sir.
Everyone in the redoubt had been injected with a subcutaneous transponder that transmitted not just their general locations, but heart rate, respiration, blood count, and brainwave patterns. Based on organic nanotechnology, the transponder was a non-harmful radioactive chemical that bound itself to an individual's glucose and the middle layers of the epidermis. The signal was relayed to the redoubt by the COMSAT, one of the two satellites to which the installation was uplinked. The telemetry transmitted from Kane's, Bridget's, and Grant's transponders scrolled upward across the screen. The computer systems recorded every byte of data sent to the COMSAT and directed it to the redoubt's hidden antennae array. Sophisticated scanning filters combed through the telemetry using special human biological encoding. The digital data stream was then routed to the console on his right, through the locational program, to precisely isolate the team's present position in time and space. The program considered and discarded thousands of possibilities within milliseconds.
Their current locations?
Marsh's fingers tapped a sequence into the keyboard, calling up the triangulation tracking program. A topographical map flashed onto the monitor screen, superimposing itself over the three icons. The little symbols inched across the computer-generated terrain.
They're still on the move. I guess they decided to drive straight through the night. They should be back here by the day after tomorrow, if they maintain their present progress.
Good work, friend Marsh.
That's Doctor. I have a PhD in astrophysics.
Like just about everyone else who came down from the moon. If we all start referring to each other by our honorifics, we'll sound like a comedy routine. Calling Dr. Marsh, Dr. Singh, Dr. Filboid.
Lakesh moved on to Bry's station. The slightly built man turned toward Lakesh, and the eyes Lakesh saw were reproachful beneath his tousled mass of coppery curls. Staring at Lakesh, he said nothing, but he meaningfully tapped the monitor screen, which displayed a drop-down window. A jagged wave slid back and forth across a CGI scale. Above the window flashed the words, "No match found."
That doesn't necessarily mean anything sinister or even significant has been gated here, Mr. Bry. Perhaps Newkirk is only returning with a piece of Anunnaki or Danann technology.
Not likely.
Lakesh turned toward Filboid. The lanky physicist stood a little over 6 feet tall, appearing to be all protruding elbows, kneecaps, and knuckles. His thinning blonde hair was swept straight back, which made his high forehead seem very high indeed. He wore a pair of black-rimmed eyeglasses. The right lens showed a spiderweb pattern of cracks. Filboid, like all of the scientists who had recently arrived in the Cerberus Redoubt from the Menetius moon colony, was a freezy, post-nuke slang for someone who had been placed in cryogenic stasis following the war.
Why do you say that?
Because if something new had been discovered of extraterrestrial origin, particularly if it were of Anunnaki manufacture, George wouldn't just beam back here with it in tow without forewarning. He knows the drill. He'd put it into decam and quarantine first.
Bry scowled up at him. Since the physicist's arrival in the redoubt, a string of tension that Lakesh attributed to professional jealousy had stretched between the two men.
Then how do you explain the energy signature on the screen?
I can't. It could just be a glitch in your scanner module, couldn't it? Your equipment is very old.
It's never happened before.
Lakesh repressed a grin. Not too long ago, he would have taken affront at the implication his systems weren't always operating at peak efficiency.
Since the materialization cycle has already begun, we might as well let it cycle through and find out for ourselves.
Bry hesitated, then sighed and returned his attention to the keyboard of his console.
Thank you.
Lakish and Filboid went to the doorway of the gate room. It was unfurnished, except for a long wooden table with a highly polished veneer. After a moment, they heard the click of the solenoids opening, and the heavy armaglass door of the jump chamber swung open on counterbalanced pivots. George Newkirk stepped down from the platform, his eyes darting back and forth as if he were looking for someone. When they fixed on Lakish, an expression of relief crossed his face.
Dr. Singh, you're here. Good.
Good? Why good?
Newkirk shifted to one side, away from the open door of the Mattrans unit. He put his right hand behind his back, and when he brought it out again, a rail pistol was gripped within his fist.
It's good, because we won't have to hunt you down. It'll save us time, and just might save the lives of the people here. Would you mind sending someone to fetch your interphaser?
Lakish had been threatened too often over the past couple of years to react with much fear. Facing the hollow bore of the rail pistol, he found himself feeling more insulted than endangered.
Friend Farrell, please summon an armed security detail.
Farrell, a shaved-headed man who affected a goatee and gold hoop earring, stared at him in surprise from the Enviro-Ops station for a handful of seconds. He activated the public address system.
Armed security detail operations, stat! Armed security detail operations!
A formal security force didn't exist as such in the installation. All of the personnel, including the recent moonbase émigrés, were required to become reasonably proficient with firearms, primarily the lightweight SA-80 subguns. The armed security detail Farrell summoned would be anyone who grabbed a gun from the armory and reached the control center under his or her own power. Newkirk's weather-beaten features locked in a hard, tight mask, and he took a threatening step forward.
Do you want to die?
No, do you?
Before Newkirk could respond, Everson suddenly appeared at Lakesh's shoulder, pushing past him into the gate room. He was a black man about Newkirk's age, and Lakish was surprised by his anger.
What the hell, George? Put down that fucking gun!
From within the jump chamber came a faint, shivery vibration. As if he had been slammed by an invisible locomotive, the man performed a complete somersault, his feet reversing positions with his head. For a crazed instant, he spun end over end in midair, making no outcry. He slammed face first into the wall beside the doorway, a scant few inches from where Lakish stood. When the crown of Everson's head touched the floor, he toppled limply forward onto his back. Lakish caught a glimpse of the man's face, and bile rose up in his throat in an acidic column. Everson's mouth gaped open. From between slack, mashed lips drooled a scattering of splintered bone mixed with little scarlet bubbles. The man's teeth and very likely all the bones in his face had been completely pulverized. His eyes were sunken deep in his sockets, as if punched back into the rear of his skull. Lakish could only gape in mind-numbed paralysis. While others in the redoubt were doing the same, figures began rushing out of the jump chamber. They were garbed identically in drab-gray armored exoskeletons. They swarmed all over the antechamber, taking up positions against facing walls. The figures appeared to be armed with a variety of hand weapons, from the pulse plasma rifles to conventional auto pistols. At a quick count, Lakish counted a baker's dozen, which comforted him somewhat. Regardless of their weaponry, the invaders were seriously outnumbered by the Cerberus personnel. Heart thudding fast and frantic within his chest, Lakish saw another figure shift within the gateway unit, walking through the wreaths of mist still swirling within it. A tall, lean man stepped down from the platform, sweeping his surroundings with a superior gaze. He walked with a flat-muscled, almost tigerish arrogance that stopped just short of a swagger. He was a warrior, that much was obvious, with the look of the hawk or a great jungle cat secure in his powers. He wore a golden helmet with incurved jaw guards, the forepart inset with jewels and inscribed with cup and spiral glyphs. A molded breastplate, apparently made of the same kind of material as his helmet, encased the upper half of his strangely elongated torso and bore odd, twisting, interlocking Celtic designs known as interlace. Spurs jangled at the heels of his knee-high black leather boots, an accessory that should have struck Lakish as absurdly superfluous, but for some reason seemed perfectly in keeping with the man who wore them. A metal gauntlet of a gleaming silver alloy covered the man's right hand and forearm, reaching almost to the crook of his elbow. At first, Lakish didn't recognize him, although his translucently pale face, the blue-white hue of skim milk, struck a distant chord of recognition. Then his wide, slanted eyes flamed up with a molten orange shimmer, and Lakish knew who he was. He didn't have the time or the opportunity to speak his name.
McCann!
Filboid's strident voice broke the chains of shock-induced paralysis weighing down Lakesh's limbs and senses.
Who are you people? What do you want?
The long-armed man Filboid had identified as McCann took another step forward, rounding the end of the table. He extended his right hand, palm outward, but not in a gesture of greeting or pacification. He stared imperiously at Lakesh, who tried but failed to return the other's fiery gaze with the same arrogant intensity. He shifted his gaze to the man's gauntlet and felt the moisture dry in his mouth to the consistency of a dusty film. Made of a segmented metal, it bore the same Celtic labyrinthine designs as McCann's helmet. Tiny threads of energy sparked from the fingertips, jumping from one to the other, then back again. Inset into the palm gleamed a round, convex lens. Miniature lightning played within it. A faint pulsing pattern, like a ripple spreading out on the surface of a pond, surrounded the man's hand, apparently exuded by the lens. Despite his mounting fear, only one thing came to Lakesh's mind. The silver hand of Nuadu.
So, this is the scientist Lakesh, the master tech smith.
Newkirk nodded nervously, the long barrel of the railgun in his hand trembling slightly.
This is Lakesh.
Ah. Do you know who I am, Lakesh?
I do.
Really? Have we met?
No. I observed you in stasis on the Manetius colony.
I see.
The fierce molten hue of McCann's eyes ebbed a bit. Lakesh recalled how Kane described the manner in which his eyes changed color according to his mood of the moment.
You will bring us your interfacer.
Lakesh stared at him in silence, his mind racing and wheeling with conjectures and wild speculations.
Did you hear me?
Yes. Why do you want it?
Don't question him!
Lakesh cast his eyes to the left and saw a dark-skinned, scar-faced woman with long, tawny hair knotted atop her head. Her gloved hand rested on the square butt of a gyrojet rocket pistol, sheathed in a vacuum-formed holster attached to the right thigh of her spacesuit. Forcing a smile to his face, Lakesh wondered what was taking the security detail so long to arrive. Then he heard a scuff of running footfalls from the operations center, and he glanced toward George Newkirk, who refused to meet his gaze.
You are a treacherous son of a bitch, and I'll bet you weren't much of a physicist either.
Then he kicked himself backward, away from the doorway, elbowing Filboid to one side in the process.
Clear operations! Evacuate the controls!
A cluster of people wearing white bodysuits, eight in all, raced down the aisle between computer stations toward the gate room. He saw only two he recognized, both of them permanent Cerberus exiles, Banks and Auerbach. The other four were Moonbase émigrés. All were armed with the little SA-80 subguns.
Keep them from leaving the gate room. Everybody else get out!
The staff obeyed with surprising alacrity, rising from their stations and rushing in an orderly fashion toward the door. Lakesh noticed Bry hadn't stirred from his console.
That means you as well, Mr. Bry. Move!
Bry regarded Lakesh with a reproachful stare, then rose and did as he was told. Lakesh sighed with relief, knowing that if he himself became a casualty, at least Bry would still function as the resident technical expert. Other than himself, Bry was the only exile who possessed a knowledge of all the operational systems of the installation. A tall, burly man with a buzz cut named Auerbach sprinted to Lakesh as they rushed toward the gate room.
What the fuck is going on?
We've got an incursion, apparently from the moon base.
A young black man with a neatly trimmed beard named Banks took up position behind a desk.
Who is it?
McCann appeared in the doorway, his face still creased in a thin smile, his eyes glowing with blood-red luminosity. One of the moonbase personnel stumbled to a halt at the sight of him.
McCann!
McCann nodded his head in his direction and thrust out his gauntleted hand. With a wave, a whirl of energy sprang from the lens on the palm of his glove and struck the moonbase worker in the center of his chest.
Ah!
The man's back arched as if he'd received a terrific blow at the base of his spine. He dropped the subgun and clawed at his chest. With a wet tearing of muscle, a snapping of bone, and the crunching of cartilage, the man's left pectoral burst open and outward. His quivering heart catapulted from his chest cavity, riding a column of blood. It shot across the intervening 2 yards as if drawn by a magnet, slapping solidly into McCann's open hand. As the corpse fell limply to the floor, his face a cyanotic blue mask of agony, McCann closed his metal-shod fingers, squeezing the man's still-beating heart as if it were a sponge. Droplets of crimson sprayed in all directions, splattering walls and speckling monitor screens, even splashing across the slack-jawed faces of Auerbach and Marsh. McCann contemptuously hurled the crushed organ at Auerbach's feet, the gesture breaking his spell of shock. A shimmering, hazy aura sprang up around McCann's gauntleted hand. Auerbach stood up in plain view and fired his SA-80, holding the trigger down. Auerbach emptied the subgun's clip and stood there, gaping at McCann, who smiled at him in return, hand still raised.
Humans, so brave, so stupid, so easy to kill. I don't know what I ever saw in you.
He stabbed his hand toward the dazed Auerbach. The ripple pattern surged toward him. Lockett bounded forward, catching Auerbach around the waist and bearing him to the floor. He heard the crash of metal and the shattering of glass as the stream of force struck a computer station. Banks began firing his subgun at McCann, and the other members of the detail did likewise. Lakesh and Auerbach crawled to cover behind a desk and watched McCann fend off the full-auto fusillade with the force field projected by his gauntlet. Sparks flew from the energy shield as the bullet struck it. Ricochets screamed and whined all around, but Lakesh felt a momentary sense of relieved triumph when he saw an expression of angry frustration cross McCann's face. He couldn't rely on his gauntlet to deflect every round fired at him, and he knew it. He backed away, retreating into the gate room.
Everyone, fall back! Farrell, drop the security doors!
Farrell's hands flew over a series of buttons on the console. A moment later, the pneumatic hissing of compressed air, the squeak of gears, and a sequence of heavy booming thuds resounded from the corridor. Heavy vanadium bulkheads dropped from the ceiling and sealed off the living quarters, engineering level, and main sector from the operations center. Alarm klaxons jangled, echoing all over the redoubt. The entrance to the control complex remained open. Lakesh glanced quizzically toward Farrell.
In case we need a place to retreat to!
Lakesh thought it over, then nodded approvingly. A pair of gray armored figures appeared in the doorway to the gate room. One of them was the scar-faced woman. The gyrojet pistol in her hand spouted a short tongue of flame, and five shots ripped across the operations room in less than 3 seconds. One of the tiny flaming projectiles slammed into Marsh in the process of running out of the control complex. It struck him in the back of the neck and bowled him off his feet, a little finger of blue fire squirting from the entrance wound as the propellant continued to burn for a second after it penetrated his body. The sweetish, sickening odor of burned flesh clogged his nostrils.
We need more people, more blasters, more Grens in here!
Lakesh didn't waste time or breath telling him that he had no intention of raising the security bulkheads now. As the woman with the gyrojet ducked out of sight, another gray-armored interloper took her place, wielding a pulse plasma emitter, one of the so-called quartz cremators.
Shit!
The torrent of incandescence just missed Auerbach as he dropped to the floor, but flew beyond and engulfed a computer station and the man using it as a breastwork. He burst into flame, transformed instantly into a capering, fire-wreathed scarecrow. He staggered drunkenly, arms windmilling. Then his body exploded from within, and viscera splattered the central control complex for 20 feet all around. Nausea roiled in Lakesh's belly when he heard the slap of body parts rain down around him.
Fuck!
The invader prepared his rifle for another shot, this time aimed directly at Lakesh. The invader's forehead erupted in a scarlet, gelatinous spray, the top portion of his face vanishing in a bloody smear. He fell backward into the antechamber, dropping the quartz cremator, his fingers snatching futilely at the air as if to grab handfuls of life. Lakesh turned his head and saw Domi, a white wraith of red-eyed fury, sidling into the operations center, holding her Detonics combat master in a double-fisted grip. His head went momentarily light with relief. Her diminutive frame was swathed in one of Lakesh's t-shirts. He wasn't sure if she wore anything under it, but at the moment he was more interested in the Bushmaster machine pistol hanging from her neck by a lanyard and the contents of the war bag slung over her right shoulder by a strap. She kicked a fallen SA-80 across the floor to Lakesh, who snatched it up like a beloved pet. Raising himself up behind the desk, he fired a short burst into the gate room, feeling a slight pang when he saw the round splat against the armorglass walls of the jump chamber. He knew the bullets wouldn't damage it, but since that particular gateway unit was the first fully debugged and operational model in the Cerberus network, he felt a strong degree of fondness for it. The man Domi had shot was dragged out of sight, and although he experienced a little guilt over the action, Lakesh fired the entire magazine at the people recovering the corpse of their comrade. He knew it hadn't hit anyone. Domi joined him, her eyes gleaming as bright and as hard as polished rubies. Her respiration came hard and fast, her breasts rising and falling under the shirt.
Damn near got squished by a sex shield. What we up against here? Who?
It's a little too complicated to go into now.
Lakesh took the Bushmaster from her. He wasn't an expert with firearms, so he turned it over in his hands, a little dismayed by how the magazine fit into the shoulder stock, behind the pistol grip and trigger guard.
Here, brace against forearm. Has 30-round clip. Select rate of fire here. Got it?
Under stress, she reverted to the abbreviated mode of outland speech. She thrust the weapon at him.
Got grins, too.
Hey, you bastards, throw down your guns and put up your hands, or we'll kill every fucking bastard in this place. Do it now!
Lakesh didn't know who shouted the order, but he knew it came from one of the armored interlopers, not McCann. Dropping the empty subgun, he put the Bushmaster stock against his shoulder and groped for the trigger.
Surrender to us!
Auerbach looked over at Lakesh with fearful eyes.
What are you going to tell him?
Domi regarded Auerbach scornfully. Then she and Lakesh rose simultaneously from behind the desk. He brought the machine pistol up, putting his left wrist under the stunted barrel. A dark-haired invader peered around the doorframe, swinging a rail pistol in Lakesh's direction. Before Lakesh could fire, Domi blasted off two rounds, pounding dents in the wall next to the man's head. He pulled back out of sight. At the same time, Banks finished switching magazines on his SA-80, his eyes bright with combat heat. He rose from behind the desk, propped his elbows atop it, and fired a short burst into the gate room. Answering fire erupted. Farrell had recovered a dropped subgun and placed it against his shoulder, opening up with a full-auto barrage into the antechamber. He ignored the bullets whistling through the air around him. The dark-haired invader showed himself again, an Uzi blazing in his right hand. Farrell suddenly stumbled as a round cored into his thigh.
Fuck you!
Domi shot into the center mass of the man who had wounded Farrell, putting him down but not penetrating his armor. Farrell half fell behind a desk, clutching at the wound in his thigh.
Farrell, raise a shield and get to the infirmary.
No damn way, Lakesh. Besides, I seal off that section first.
A movement in his peripheral vision caused Lakesh to turn. He saw Phil Boyd elbow crawling between the desks, gripping an SA-80. He made his way over to Farrell and gave his leg a quick, cursory examination.
The proverbial flesh wound.
What are you doing here? I ordered the operation center evacuated.
This is my home too now.
Do you know any of these people?
I don't personally, but I imagine they're what's left of Saladin's troop of McCann followers.
Can you tell me anything about the armor they're wearing?
We called them hard suits, designed for excavation out on the lunar surface. Unless you've got some armor-piercing rounds, I don't think you'd be able to shoot through them.
Lakesh looked away, gritting his teeth in a combination of frustrated fury and fear. His back ached from crouching in such a cramped position for so long, and perspiration slicked his body under his clothes, making him feel like he was wearing a bog. He realized even if the Cerberus personnel kept McCann and his warriors hemmed within the gate room, they had the superior weapons, and their return fire was destroying precious, perhaps irreplaceable equipment. If the mainframe computer was damaged, Lakesh seriously doubted it could ever be repaired. Domi inched closer to him, her porcelain face tight with tension. She patted the war bag.
Got some gas grins in here. Couple of flashbangs. Might discourage him.
Lakesh nodded, but he was dubious such actions would work. However, he knew some kind of offensive action needed to be taken soon to break the standoff. He couldn't even speculate on the uses McCann intended for the interfacer, but he knew whatever they might be, none of them in Cerberus would benefit. The only reasonable tactic Lakesh could perceive was to make the situation so desperate for McCann and his people that they would be anxious to gate back to where they'd come from. However, Lakesh couldn't quite figure out how to do it without incurring more casualties. He found himself wishing fervently Kane, Grant, and Bridget were present in the redoubt. When they worked in tandem, they seemed to exert an almost supernatural influence on the scales of chance, usually tipping them in their favor. Almost as soon as the notion registered, like a cue, McCann's voice floated to him.
Where is the man named Kane? Bring him to me, and perhaps we can negotiate a settlement. Find an alternative to all this bloodshed.
Domi and Lakesh exchanged nervous, worried glances. After a moment, Lakesh replied.
There's nothing to negotiate. I won't give you what you want, so you might as well leave. That is the most logical option left to you if you wish to avoid more bloodshed.
No! Very well. I won't bother trying to be civilized. Just bring him forward. I'd so enjoy the chance to talk with him again.
Before Lakesh could frame even a noncommittal response, Farrell rose slightly from behind the desk.
Kane isn't here right now, but he'll be back directly. You could wait for him, I guess, but there won't be a point to it, because you'll be deader than fucking hell by the time he gets here!
During Farrell's maddened rant, Lakesh waved at him, trying to persuade him to stop talking, not to give away any information. But the man was too consumed by pain and rage to have complied, even if he had paid attention to Lakesh's hand gestures.
I suppose we'll just have to do this the hard way.
That may not be necessary. Perhaps a compromise is possible. What do you need the interfacer for?
I doubt you'd understand, my friend.
Lakesh peered over the edge of the desk. Domi followed suit, cautiously rising to eye level. At that moment, one of the interlopers came charging out of the gate room, a plasma rifle held at waist level, aiming at Domi and Lakesh's position. Philboyd rose to his feet.
Laszlo, is that you?
The man tried to alter his aim in Philboyd's direction, but Lakesh fired first. The Bushmaster's line of steel-jacketed death tore into the man's head, ripping bloody chunks out of his face. Staggering backward, Laszlo's finger pressed convulsively on the firing plate of the quartz cremator, and a crackling stream of lethal energy burst from the barrel. Lakesh dropped behind the desk, pulling Domi with him. By the time the armored man hit the floor, another interloper surged out of the antechamber. It was the scar-faced woman. Without hesitation, Lakesh pulled the trigger of his Bushmaster. The stream of 9mm subsonic rounds caught the woman in her armored chest and knocked her back into the gate room. Even as she fell, she managed to retrieve the quartz cremator, snatching it by the barrel. Her reeling fall seemed to be a signal. The invaders began a surging charge into the operation center, but were hampered by their bulky suits and the relative narrowness of the doorway. Only two could squeeze through at a time, firing their weapons in a wild frenzy as they did so. Bullets and tungsten carbide pellets ricocheted all over the complex. Fire was directed upward, toward the neon light strips stretched across the high ceiling. Several of them sputtered with a shower of sparks and went out, plunging the command center into semi-darkness. Philboyd raised his SA-80, pulling the trigger and unleashing three-round bursts. Farrell lurched upright and stood shoulder to shoulder with him, firing with his own weapon. The blistering full-auto cannonade hammered into the front line of invaders, knocking them off their feet, sending them staggering. Banks picked off two men, placing shots through their unprotected heads. They flailed and went down. Two other men got their legs tangled with those casualties. Lakesh managed to drill one through the side of his skull, but his companion struggled free and scooted back into the antechamber on the seat of his hard suit. The other invaders retreated into the gate room. Farrell continued firing, keeping the trigger pressed down, not relaxing the pressure until the magazine cycled dry.
Get out, you stupid bastards!
When a bullet fired from the gate room came too close to him, Philboyd wrestled the man down behind the desk again, throwing Lakesh a feeble grin.
Yeah, hell of a party.
Lakesh felt a swell of pride at the bravery displayed by Farrell and Philboyd. He felt less kindly disposed toward Auerbach, who cowered under a nearby desk, hugging his knees. He heard a commotion from the antechamber. Judging by the profanity, as well as the meaty smack of blows being struck, he guessed that McCann and his warriors had not expected such fierce resistance. Apparently, George Newkirk had underestimated the resolve of the Cerberus residents and was the target of the vituperation.
McCann!
Right here. I don't plan on taking my leave anytime soon.
That's a shame, because you're losing people. Far more than is necessary.
I'm not keeping score. All I know is that I don't have the interphaser.
You're not likely to get it either. The part of the installation where it is kept is completely sealed off from this section. You're basically trapped.
I don't see it that way. Besides, I've been basically trapped before. You might have heard of my prison. It's called the Moon.
I know about your imprisonment, but from what I was told, it was self-imposed captivity.
Indeed. From where or whom did you hear that?
It doesn't matter. Tell me why you need my interfacer.
I need it to help me take a long, final look in the mirror. To step through the looking glass.
Do you even know what my interfacer is?
Of course I do. It's a device constructed on the scientific principles my kind gave to your people millennia ago.
If that's the case, then why do you need mine? Build one yourself.
I don't have the time or patience.
Lakesh replayed McCann's enigmatic comment about mirrors and looking glasses, and despite the situation, found himself intrigued.
Mirror symmetry? Is that what you're talking about? The mirror matter theory?
I suggest you give me what I want, Lakesh. I'll answer all your questions then.
That's not going to happen.
Oh, dear Dr. Singh, I believe it will.
Domi rose to her knees, and a single shot fired from the gate room plucked at her hair. She didn't take cover. Her hand dipped into the war bag and brought out an Ulcetex concussion grenade, a flashbang. Lips peeling back over her teeth in a silent snarl, Domi waited until another target presented itself. For a fleeting second, a man peered around the edge of the door. Her finger caressed the trigger of her combat master, and one round took off the top of the interloper's head in a mist of blood. Domi lunged forward, tucking and rolling and coming up under a desk. Lakesh focused on the doorway to the anteroom. He saw Domi rise and run at an oblique angle for the gate room, the flashbang gripped in her left hand. She slipped the spoon and hurled it through the doorway in one smooth motion. The grenade exploded a heartbeat later with an eardrum-piercing bang and an eruption of dazzling white light. Domi sprinted back across the operations center as a barrage of gunfire erupted from the antechamber. When the fire from the gate room tapered off, Lakesh raised his head.
Newkirk? George Newkirk? Are you still alive in there?
What do you want, Lakesh?
I want you to leave. Get back in the jump chamber and go.
Back where we came from?
Not necessarily. I don't care where you go. But it's inadvisable to stay here much longer.
Leaving before we get what we came for isn't part of the plan.
But getting yourself and your friends killed is? You've seen the armory here. We could lob high explosive grenades in there or use rocket launchers on you any time we cared to. Did you tell McCann about that?
You could do that, but you won't.
Lakesh tightened his hands on the Bushmaster.
And why not?
I don't doubt that if Grant or Kane, or even Baptiste were here, they'd agree to a collateral damage tactic like that. But they're gone, and that's why I chose this time to act. Didn't that occur to you?
Why are you so sure I won't take the same action as they would?
A couple of reasons. First of all, you're a humanitarian. Secondarily, you don't want to risk destroying your life's work.
The jump chamber? Don't be ridiculous.
Despite his tone, Lakesh did take a great deal of pride in the Cerberus Matrans unit, since it was the first one built after the prototypes. It had served as the basic template for all the others that followed.
Not just that. The entire redoubt and everyone in it. By the time you drive us out or kill us, Cerberus will be useless to you, either as a sanctuary or a home. By the time we're done, we'll turn it into a mortuary. I can guarantee that.
You crazy son of a bitch! Why are you doing this? All of us who were trapped on the moon are finally back on Earth. We have a chance for a future.
This isn't the kind of future any of us wants. You destroyed what we had going up on the colony.
All you had going for you was an insane suicide pact, struck between a couple of insane aliens who thought they were gods.
Lakesh didn't involve himself in the argument. The situation was definitely a stalemate, but he didn't doubt George Newkirk's conviction. He had also accurately gauged Lakesh's feelings about the Cerberus Redoubt and the people in it. He heard a short warning hiss from where Domi had taken cover, and he peered around the corner of the desk. She had removed a CS gas canister from her war bag and held it up, eyebrows raised toward him meaningfully. He shook his head, indicating she should wait. The girl scowled at him and shook her head in response, rising to her feet. She moved along the wall toward the doorway. Lakesh watched her progress, a chill hand of dread at the base of his spine. He also felt more than a little angry. He seriously doubted Domi would so blatantly have disobeyed an order from either Kane or Grant under like circumstances.
Enough of this. Decide on a course of action, Lakesh. My followers and I have nothing to lose, therefore everything to fight for. Give me what I want, or prepare to wade in blood. Yours and mine.
Lakesh waved frantically to Domi, shaking his head and mouthing, "No!" Domi merely narrowed her eyes, pinched away the gas gren's pin, and hurled it with a looping overarm throw. It passed through the doorway, trailing a little stream of acrid vapor. When it struck the floor beyond, it erupted with a loud pop and spewed a billowing plume of white smoke. Almost immediately, the gate room was engulfed by clouds of roiling vapor. Yells and shouted commands became incomprehensible as the gas seared eyes, lungs, and nostrils. The interlopers coughed and gagged, groping for whiffs of fresh air. Two of them opened up with their autoblasters at the doorway. One of them raked the ceiling, blowing out more of the light strips. Gloom shrouded almost all of the operations center. Banks, Farrell, Phil Boyd, and the other defenders didn't return fire. They ducked down behind their shelters. Dark shapes shifted through the planes of gas, fanning out of the gate room. The chemical vapors wafted into the command center. Lakesh heard Domi as she tried to suppress her coughing. The result Lakesh had feared became a reality when the invaders used the CS gas cloud as a screen to cover their charge into the operations complex. The security detail triggered their weapons, but those nearest to the gate room coughed and gagged as they inhaled the gas, their eyes tearing from the touch of it. Lakesh rose from behind the desk, but he didn't fire his Bushmaster, fearful of hitting Domi. Squinting against the chemical fog, he saw that the invaders wore rebreathers, transparent respiration masks that covered their nostrils and mouths with goggles to protect their eyes. Slender, flexible tubes corkscrewed from the lower edges of the mask and stretched to epaulets on their shoulders. He guessed the epaulets contained small, emergency oxygen tanks. The billowing cloud of vapor dimmed the few overhead lights still shedding illumination, so it was almost impossible to track the invaders. Banks, Phil Boyd, and a few others squeezed off several rounds from their SA-80s, shooting into the cloud at different angles, trying to bring the shifting shadows into target acquisition. Lakesh glimpsed Domi dropping her combat master's sights over one of the armored men lunging out of the gate room. The bullet slammed through the back of the interloper's head, jerking him forward. The next barrage of rounds from the surviving invaders crashed into a computer station, tearing metal loose and sending sparks cascading high into the air. Cursing, Lakesh shifted his weapon, targeting a man's upper body. The three bullets hit the man in the shoulder and spun him around like a top. Lakesh missed with his next burst, then fired again, hitting the man above the neckline of his breastplate, crushing the spine and ripping out his throat in a geyser of blood. A bullet whipped past Lakesh's face, and he felt rather than heard the little slap of displaced air. It had missed him by no more than an inch, and it had come from the general direction of the security detail.
Cease fire! You'll hit each other! Cease fire!
Through the jiggling, burning water in his eyes, he caught glimpses of shapes moving through the billowing chemical vapors, spreading out all over the command center. Lakesh dropped to all fours, trying to control his breathing. His eyes leaked tears, and he felt sick to his stomach. He crawled forward, toward the main entrance. An invader, having as much trouble seeing as the defenders, stumbled to a stop no more than 3 feet away. He caught sight of Lakesh and brought his assault rifle to his shoulder. Lakesh lifted the Bushmaster first, firing a 3-round burst, the bullets hammering into his chest and knocking him down, flares sparking from the impact points.
You two, move over to...
Farrell tried to organize a flanking maneuver, but his words clogged in his throat. Autofire drove the defenders back, the rounds tearing through desks and computer terminals. Another invader crossed Lakesh's blurry line of vision, and he fired. The armor stopped the rounds and most of the blunt trauma, but the zigzag line of bullets stitched the man from hip to shoulder, sending him staggering out of sight. A brilliant blue flash pulsed in the room, synchronized with the characteristic crackle of the quartz cremator. He heard a brief scream, then a mushy explosion. He bit back a cry of horror when he felt something hot and wet slap the back of his neck. Crawling quickly, he made it to the door.
Domi! Domi!
He received no response when he called Domi's name. By the sound of it, the battle had resolved itself into a hand-to-hand slugging match. Cries of pain, half-gagged curses, the crash of bodies slamming into furniture, and the meaty impact of flesh against flesh replaced gunshots. Slowly, he rose, squinting through the vapors. Shadow shapes shifted all around him, and he drove the butt of the Bushmaster at one. He missed and nearly fell. Then a rush of bodies knocked him sprawling out into the corridor. He lost his grip on his machine gun, hearing it clatter out of reach. Metal-shod knees pressed into his stomach and a pair of large, gloved hands closed around his neck and squeezed. Lakesh heaved, bucked, and twisted, blinking back tears to see a distorted face bobbing over him. The interloper was by far the stronger, and he easily resisted each of Lakesh's efforts to throw him off. Lakesh hammered at him with his fists, but he struck only his armored chest.
I got him! I got Lakesh! I got...
Elbowing the dead weight from his body, Lakesh rolled away and got to his feet. From what he could see through the gas-shrouded murk, the command center was engulfed by screaming chaos. He couldn't discern who was whom. He turned, scanning the floor for his Bushmaster. 2 yards from the entrance to operations, the passageway was bisected on both sides by the security bulkheads. Before he could locate his weapon, he heard Domi's voice rising wild and shrill. He caught only a fragmented glimpse of her using her knees and elbows to break free of an invader's grasp. Then a gloved hand chopped at the side of her neck, and she dropped out of sight. Concerned for the girl making him reckless, Lakesh bounded back into the operations center. He had taken only a few steps when a hand closed around his neck from behind, squeezing with an agonizing pressure. His nervous system was almost overwhelmed by the sudden pain. He clawed at the wrist, but his fingernails scraped futilely on metal segments. He felt a round object pressing against the base of his skull and realized instantly it was the lens on the palm of McCann's gauntlet. Panicky images of his skull exploding filled his mind, and he struggled madly to pry McCann's alloy-shod fingers apart. He back-kicked desperately. McCann's hand mercilessly crushed tendon, muscle, and ligaments against his vertebrae. Distantly, with a detached sense of horror, he heard the dry creak of bone.
Don't dare kill me. Never figure out how to operate interfacer.
McCann flung Lakesh aside as if he weighed no more than a dummy filled with straw. He landed on his left side, the impact knocking what little breath he had left out through his nostrils and mouth. He lay where he had been tossed, his face against the littered floor of the operations room, trying to cough, to move, to breathe. He heard and felt glass crunching beneath him. His head throbbed in cadence with his pulse. The world spun and tilted around him. Then voices were snarling, shouting, and cursing all around him. Rough hands hauled him to his feet. Lakesh blinked his eyes against the chemical-induced tears swimming in them. All he could see in the smoky murk was the gray armor of the invader's hard suits. He found himself standing in the center of a tight circle of foes. He couldn't help but smile in grim satisfaction when he noticed the smallness of the circle. He counted only 3 of the hard-suited invaders. His people had acquitted themselves well, more than well, in exemplary fashion, despite the fact he saw only Filboid and Banks standing up. He assumed Auerbach still cowered beneath a desk and hadn't been spied.
What's so fucking funny?
Lakesh looked at the man, white with rage and humiliation, and said nothing. But his smile widened. The back of the invader's hand smacked across Lakesh's mouth, his teeth cutting into his lower lip. He reeled backward and spit crimson at the man's feet. McCann strode to him, his eyes glowing like red-hot coals. Their crimson intensity put Lakesh in mind of the mouths of furnaces, or apertures to hell.
Raise the security shields.
Lakesh turned his smile into a smirk, despite the pain it caused him.
Blow it out your ass.
McCann's eyes widened, and Lakesh felt his throat constrict. He suddenly remembered McCann's psionic assault on Kane, and he steeled himself to receive a telepathic attack. Instead, the helmeted man turned away and made a short, sharp gesture with his gauntleted hand.
Bring her shade.
The scar-faced woman stalked forward, dragging a struggling Domi. Her respiration mask was missing, and the flesh around her left eye was puffy, fast swelling shut. Judging by her bare-toothed grimace of anger, she held Domi responsible. She twisted both of the girl's arms in painful hammerlocks, holding her hands up between her shoulder blades. The girl refused to cry out or to meet Lakesh's eyes. Tension coiled in the pit of his belly.
Raise the security shields, please.
Lakesh refused to answer, keeping his face impassive. McCann smiled coldly, then stepped over to Domi, extended his gauntlet-clad right hand, positioning it close to her head, fingers spread wide. Tiny skeins of electricity sizzled along the fingers, and Domi's eyes followed their thready arcs.
I knew men like you of old. Warriors, noble chieftains of a brave people. You would rather die than betray their trust or bow to torture. But to stand by and watch pain inflicted on one of those who are under your protection.
With the deliberate swiftness of a striking snake, McCann's hand darted forward and clasped the upper portion of Domi's head, the round lens pressing against her forehead. Her white face twisted, contorted, lips writhing back over her teeth in a silent shriek. She squeezed her eyes shut as a ripple spread over her piquant features. Her petite form shuddered violently. Lakesh received the distinct impression she was too consumed by agony to even scream. Blood suddenly sprayed from both delicate nostrils. Lakesh strained against the arms holding him.
Enough! Damn you! Stop! I'll do what you want! Stop!
McCann didn't remove his hand. He continued to grin at Lakesh as Domi's body went into spasms. Her eyes rolled back into her head, showing only the whites. Saliva drooled from her slack lips, mixing with the blood streaming from her nose and over her chin. Lakesh threw himself against the arms pinioning him, but was unable to break their grip. He knew McCann's device was disrupting Domi's molecular structure, breaking it down, battering every bone, organ, and cell in her body. In a matter of seconds, Domi would be dead.
Stop! I give you my word! I'll do whatever you say!
McCann nodded graciously, as if he had finally heard the words he wanted to hear, and pulled his hand away from Domi's head. She slumped forward, sagging limply in Shade's hands, her head lolling loosely on her neck.
You may let her go now. I think both she and Lakesh have been made more tractable.
Shade released her hammerlock on Domi and allowed the girl to fall heavily to the floor. She lay unmoving, curled up in a ball. Lakesh stared at her, barely able to form words due to the terror clouding his mind. He could scarcely detect signs of respiration.
Will she be all right?
I really couldn't say. Now, for the third and final time, open the security shields.
Lakesh squinted through the thinning clouds of vapor until he saw Banks standing with the bore of Newkirk's rail pistol pressed against the side of his head.
Friend Banks, if you will do as McCann demands, I will be very appreciative.
Banks cut his eyes sideways, glaring at Newkirk. He seemed to be on the verge of arguing. Then he wheeled away from the railgun and marched to an intact computer station. He tapped a numerical sequence into a keyboard, and within a few seconds came the squeak and creak of hydraulics as the bulkhead began to rise. McCann cautiously peered around the edge of the doorway, looking both ways. A burst of gunfire filled the corridor with a staccato drumming. A spark jumped from the top of his helmet, and he hastily withdrew his head. With a rueful smile creasing his lips, he touched the small dent on his headpiece with his left hand. His eyes acquired a deep yellow hue.
Some of your people are lying in wait for us.
I'm not surprised.
McCann gestured to the woman called Shade, then over to Newkirk.
Once Lakish and I are out, if you hear anything remotely resembling a gunshot, kill everyone in here. Then go through the rest of this place. Kill every person you see, man, woman, child, or otherwise.
He swept his gauntleted hand imperiously toward the prone body of Domi.
Starting with her.
Shade touched the welt around her eye and flashed Lakish a savage grin.
Be happy to.
McCann beckoned to Lakish with a forefinger to join him at the doorway. When he did, McCann placed his right hand on the back of his neck. The pent-up energies pulsing within the lens felt like a weak static discharge playing up and down his spine.
Instruct your people to let us pass unmolested. Otherwise, you will live just long enough to know the hostages here have been put to painful deaths.
Lakish swallowed hard and nodded in agreement. He allowed McCann to push him out into the passageway. Looking to the left, he glimpsed Wegman, the slightly built, balding engineer, positioned at a corner, sighting down a rifle. On his right, he saw at least three other gun barrels protruding from around a bend in the corridor.
I've made an agreement with our visitors. I'm taking him to the workroom, and then we'll be returning here, whereupon he and his companions will leave. You will leave, right?
Of course.
They began walking down the wide corridor, adopting a casual gait as if they were just two friends out for a stroll. McCann did not speak, and at first Lakish was just as glad. They passed a quartet of redoubt personnel. Lakish was dismayed, but not overly surprised, to see DeFore standing among them. She followed their progress with angry eyes and the barrel of a Colt Scamp machine pistol.
Say the word, Lakish. Say it, and I'll drop him.
Metal-encased fingers tightened on his neck, and Lakish winced.
This is McCann. You remember what Bridget, Kane, and Grant had to say about him?
The medic's eyes widened, the anger suddenly displaced by fear. She lowered her weapon and stepped back, allowing them to pass.
Does anyone need medical attention?
Too damn many, thanks to our visitor.
They continued down the corridor.
Ah, this reputation of mine gets out of hand now and then.
Do you think so? I'd say it's richly deserved.
Perhaps. Sometimes it's to my advantage. Other times it can be a damn nuisance. But if you'd known me 2,000 years ago...
I probably would have found you just as intolerably obnoxious as I do now.
Fire seemed to ripple out of the gauntlet lens, a force that streaked along the length of his spine. For a sliver of an instant, Lakish had the impression of being stung simultaneously by 100 wasps all up and down the buttons of his backbone. The flaming agony seemed to erupt from the nerve roots outward. The pain vanished immediately, before he could drag enough breath to cry out.
Understand.
I understand.
Good boy.
They turned a corner and entered the workroom adjacent to the armory. Rows of drafting tables with T-squares hanging from their sides lined one wall. McCann removed his hand from the back of Lakish's neck.
Show me your miraculous device.
Lakish walked to a long, low trestle table and pointed to an object that resembled a very squat, broad-based pyramid made of smooth, dark metal. Side panels were open and revealed a confusing mass of circuit boards and microprocessors gleaming within. The pyramid was barely 1 foot in overall width, its height not exceeding 10 inches. From the base protruded a small power unit and a keypad. McCann eyed it critically, crossing his arms over his chest.
So this is your interfacer.
Interfacer version 2.0.
It's what brought you to the moon.
The interfacer interacted with the energy within a naturally occurring vortex and caused a temporary overlapping of two dimensions. The vortex then became an intersection point, a discontinuous quantum jump beyond relativistic space-time. Evidence had indicated that there were many vortex nodes, centers of intense energy, located in the same proximity on each of the planets of the solar system, and those points correlated to vortex centers on Earth. The power points of the planet, places that naturally generated specific types of energy, possessed both positive and projective frequencies. Others were negative and receptive. Lakish referred to the positive energy as prana, which was an old Sanskrit term meaning the world soul. Lakish had known that some ancient civilizations were aware of these symmetrical geoenergies and had constructed monuments over the vortex points to manipulate them. Once the interfacer was put into use, the Cerberus Redoubt reverted to its original purpose, not a sanctuary for exiles or the headquarters of a resistance against the tyranny of the barons, but a facility dedicated to unraveling the eternal mysteries of space and time. However, everyone was nonplussed when one set of parallax points coordinates led to a location not just above solid ground, but off the planet itself, on the moon. All of them knew the stories about pre-dark space settlements, even of bases on the moon, of course. It wasn't until they activated the parallax points coordinate that they learned the stories about moon bases were far more than folklore.
Fascinating device. My compliments.
Thank you.
But it is more than merely fascinating. Perhaps it can serve as the means to my ultimate salvation.
How so?
McCann regarded him gravely. His eyes were now a pale pewter gray, but Lakesh wasn't comforted. The helmeted man didn't speak for a long moment, as if he were pondering a weighty problem.
Perhaps I should take you with me, so you may learn the answer to that question yourself, and in doing so help me attain my objective. I promise you you'd find it an astonishing experience.
I've visited Manetius Base. There's not much there you can show me that I'll find particularly astonishing.
Who said anything about going to the moon?
Then where?
McCann cast his eyes toward the ceiling and kept his gaze there, as if he could see through vanadium, solid rock, and the atmosphere.
The fourth planet from the sun, Dr. Singh. I call it Lamu. You call it Mars.
Grant nearly had all the spark plug leads hooked back up to the distributor cap when Kane interrupted him.
Hey, Grant. What's holding things up?
He struggled to keep the wires together and his temper from fraying any further. He speared Kane with angry eyes.
Trying to do engine work when it's damn near dark. Bridget, hold that damn light steady.
I'm trying to. I'm getting cold.
We're all getting cold.
I'm hungry, too.
We're all hungry. It might make more sense to leave the Jeep here and go the rest of the way on foot.
I warned you about taking the Jeep instead of the Hussar or a Sandcat, didn't I?
Yeah, but you also agreed it would draw less attention. With what's happened lately, we don't need to make ourselves any more conspicuous in the Outlands.
Grant returned to his work. Kane stepped away, pulling up the collar of his jacket. All of them wore jackets against the chill creeping down from the mountain peaks. The clouds had lowered around the Bitterroot Range, bringing veils of mist and a more persistent drizzle. It cut down on visibility, not that there was much to see as twilight deepened, a sea of russet and indigo flowing down from the western sky. The last few minutes of sunset were strikingly beautiful, as they always were in the Outlands. Massive pollutants and lingering radiation did that to a sunset. The three of them were now 2.5 long, hard days from Crescent City. Other than a skirmish with a group of scavengers who coveted their vehicle, the return trip had been relatively quiet. Now, Kane almost wished they had given the Jeep over to them, since about an hour ago it had sputtered, shuddered, and finally died altogether. Well over 200 years ago, before the world had died in a nuclear inferno, the vehicle had started life as a mil-spec army jeep. Since then, it had been pieced back together at least a half dozen times by people with various degrees of skills and limited access to parts. Metal patches welded over the body showed signs of rust, ripped open in places by dents and dings. Kane and Grant had captured it from a band of roamers who'd been traveling too close to the Bitterroot Range a few months back. The encounter had resulted in some of the new bullet holes decorating the wag's body. But the vehicle provided good cover for the overland journey, not quite as attention-getting as a Sandcat or a Hussar Hotspur available in the redoubt. The downside of traveling in a less conspicuous vehicle like the Jeep was the exposure to the often lethal elements around hell zones, the least of which were the showers of acid rain. Fortunately, the weather had held on the return trip, and when they skirted hell zones, their instruments showed tolerable levels of ambient radiation. Only twice did they come near orange or warm regions. The far western inland states had, for the most part, been spared multiple direct strikes. Kane jumped and spun around, biting back a startled curse. Grant met his irritated gaze with one of mild amusement.
Ah, if it was only a plug, then it's fixed.
They all climbed back aboard. Once settled in behind the wheel, Grant turned the ignition key. The Jeep engine roared to life, running smoothly and without a single stutter or stammer. Grant experimentally pressed down on the accelerator a time or two to race the engine. When it continued to run without hesitation, he engaged the gears and set off up the road again.
With luck, we should be home before the moon rises.
Almost be better if we didn't. Then our visibility would improve.
Grant turned on the headlights, the jeep skirting the crumbling edge of the road. The ground looked solid, but it was deceptive. Even the vehicle's four-wheel drive might not be enough to get them free if the road began to collapse under its weight. Twisting the wheel in one direction, then turning it the other, Grant rode the brakes, all the while watching for familiar landmarks. Grant guided the jeep expertly, with gravel rattling beneath the wheels and chassis, traveling along the high, far side of the road to avoid the crumbling edges. When the highway swung in a wide curve along the backside of a ridge, Bridget, Kane, and Grant released their pent-up breath in a long exhalation of relief.
About the worst is behind us now. We should be in comm range. Give him a holler.
Kane picked up the transcom from the seat. Thumbing up the cover of the palm-sized radio phone, he pressed a key, held it up to his ear, and spoke into it.
This is Rover. Do you read me, Cerberus? Acknowledge. Cerberus, do you read me?
Irritably, he folded down the unit cover.
Could be the cloud cover blocking the signal.
Try again when we're closer. You'd think they'd be expecting us.
Lakesh didn't seem too enthusiastic about this mission in the first place.
It's probably because he didn't come up with it. He still wants the final say on all ops.
He had a point about this particular mission. It wasn't a strike against either the Barons or the Imperator. We hurt Baron Snakefish by accident, not by design. And since he and Sam are allies, Sam will more than likely resupply Snakefish's Ville with anything he lost.
It's a new war. We have to come up with new strategies.
It's a new phase of the same old war. We may have more allies to go along with more enemies, but the war is the same.
Kane nodded reflectively, remembering all the times he had told Lakesh that a war that was already lost could not be fought. A new one had to be waged. It wasn't until they learned that the Archon Directorate didn't exist that they devoted much thought to the means of waging the new war. Before then, the missions Lakesh concocted never dealt with head-on confrontations. Always, they involved finding some way to strike covertly at the Archon Directorate, not at the Barons, their plenipotentiaries, who actually held the reins of power. After Balaam's revelation that the Directorate was but a diversionary smokescreen, created 2 centuries ago by corrupt government officials and military men to mask their own ruthless ambitions, an entirely new set of strategies had to be drafted. The earlier tactics had been hampered by their own belief that they contended with a vast, omnipotent opponent, and by Kane's way of thinking, they wasted a lot of time and energy searching for ways to fight an enemy that didn't exist. He couldn't really blame Lakesh, particularly in view of the fact that he was the man who came to the pivotal conclusion that the Directorate was but a cunningly crafted illusion. Even so, he seemed reluctant to accept the findings of his own detective work, despite Balaam's essentially confirming his suspicions. Not that it really mattered at this point. Lakesh's self-assumed position as the final authority in the redoubt was no longer absolute. A smile tugged at the corners of Kane's mouth. It wasn't as if he, Grant, and Bridget had ever obeyed him unquestioningly in the first place, but now any proposals for actions had to be agreed upon by a majority vote. Kane knew Lakesh bitterly resented this change in procedure, but to hell with him. His plans had nearly gotten them all killed, or worse, on a number of occasions. Lakesh often gave them just enough information to plunge them into serious trouble. That was all over now. Lakesh was a changed man. Or at least, Kane hoped so. The jeep, all 4 tires gripping the cracked asphalt, topped another rise, turned another curve, and Grant exhaled a deep sigh of relief as the road widened to the huge plateau. Kane tried raising the redoubt on the transcom again, but once more received only static.
They have to be receiving us.
Kane nodded, but folded the cover down over the comm and put it in his pocket. He didn't voice the anxiety that had crept over him like a shroud since their breakdown. His sixth sense howled an alarm. The skin between his shoulder blades seemed to tighten, and the short hairs at the back of his neck tingled. Grant steered the jeep in a semicircle around the plateau and braked to a halt, only a few yards away from the sector. It was completely closed. Normally, one of the panels was left open until midnight, when the security watch closed it. As it was, the security watch should have been alerted to their arrival by the motion detectors planted around the perimeter and the night vision vid system.
I don't like the looks of this.
That makes 2 of us. How about you?
I'm with you.